Dakota has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
Hey, next on the T Nation, thanks for tuning into this very special segment of the show featuring Jay Haas. Jay won 27 times between the PGA Tour and the Champions Tour, finished in the top 10 in majors 14 times, and has won 3 majors so far out on the Champions Tour. Jay is a fantastic guy, so much fun. I can't tell you how much I enjoyed the amount of time that I got to spend with him earlier this week. Jay is a multi-award winner. He won the 1975 National Championship when he was at Wake Forest. He's also won the Payne Stewart Award. He won the Bob Jones Award. On top of all of that, we've got mutual friends that have put us together. Tom Pertzer, thank you so very much for connecting Jay and I. Rob Strano as well for cluing me in on what a great guy Jay Haas is. So sit back, relax, and enjoy this very special segment of the show. Folks, before we get started today, you've heard me talk about some great products that I saw at the PGA Merchandise Show. And another one that stood out to me is On Point Golf. Game-changing, three-dimensional ball markers that science shows will help us see the line better when we're putting and therefore make more putts and lower our scores. See for yourself why Jim Furyk and I are big fans by going online to onpointgolf.us. Now next on the tee with me is Jay Haas. Let me give you some more detail about what he has done over the course of his career than I did just a moment ago. Jay is from St. Louis, Missouri, and played his college golf at Wake Forest from 1973 to 1976, where he was a four-time All-American, including a first-team All-American in 1975 and 76. He was the medalist at the 1975 National Championship after finishing tied for sixth in 1974. He helped the Demon Deacons to back-to-back national championships in 1974 and 75. He turned pro a little bit later on in 76. He won 9 times out on the PGA Tour, including being in the top 10 14 times in majors. He's won 18 times so far on the Champions Tour, including 3 majors. He won the Senior PGA Championship twice in 2006 and 2008, plus the 2009 Senior Players Championship. He also won the Liberty Mutual Legends of Golf twice, and he took home the Charles Schwab Cup in 2006 and again in 2008. In 2005, Jay won the Payne Stewart Award for representing the character, charity, and sportsmanship that Payne showed. In 2006, Jay was presented with the Bob Jones Award, which is given annually in recognition of distinguished sportsmanship in the game of golf. In 2022, Jay became the oldest player to ever make the cut in a PGA Tour tournament. At 68, he and his son Bill both made the cut at the Zurich Classic and both finished tied for 36 at 12 under par. Along with his 27 career wins, Jay has 34 second place finishes, 152 top fives, and 278 top tens. Jay is the nephew of 1968 Masters champion Bob Golby. His brother Jerry, sons Bill and Jay Jr., plus his nephew Dillard Pruitt also played out on the PGA Tour. And I couldn't be more thrilled. I get to have Jay with me this week here on Next on the Tee. Hey, Jay, thanks for coming on the show.
No, it's my pleasure, Chris. That sounded like you made up a bunch of that stuff that you just read.
I have not, as a matter of fact. Good for you.
Holy cow. Been a long time, I tell you. Game's been unbelievable to me. And I've met so many wonderful people throughout my time, and the golf part of it on the course was terrific, but just everything around it has been amazing and very blessed.
Jay, so going back to the beginning, the golf gene obviously runs strong in your family. Was it Mr. Golby that got you started? Was it your parents? How did you first start playing the game?
You know, it was my Uncle Bob. You know, I was 5 years old, probably put a cut down club in my hand and gave me a couple tips, and I don't really remember so much. I've seen pictures of me swinging and things like that, but I think even today I do a clinic and I talk about belt buckle to the target and up on my right toe. You know, that was, I think, the first lesson that I had, and probably lasted me you know, 5 or 6 years, and then he maybe told me something else. But that was my introduction to the game. And, you know, Bob taught me so much about the swing itself, but mostly about shot making, say, and then how to be a pro, I think, was his biggest asset that I gleaned from him throughout the years. And, you know, he had his buddies were, you know, Gene Littler and Miller Barber and Mason Rudolph, and in the era of Arnold and Jack and Billy Casper, and golly, the names go on. And so I got to hang with some of those guys and see all sorts of personalities and all sorts of swings too. You know, there wasn't a cookie cutter back then. You didn't have the YouTube to look at the slow motion swings of all the greats. So everybody kind of made their swing out of the dirt. And I guess I was no different. But Bob taught me the game, got me started. My dad was a pretty good player when I was younger, and he was the one who took me to play because Bob was playing tournament golf and I didn't get to see him a whole lot. But dad would take me out and hang my bag on the umbrella of his pull cart, you know, of his bag. And I'd walk along, and I can recall the first drives that I really would get into would go about 100, 105 yards. That was the benchmark, was 100. The three digit mark was as far as I could hit it way back then. But some memories that I will never forget. Very, very, very fond.
Speaking of memories, you're from St. Louis, as is another great friend of this show who I believe you grew up with, and that's Rob Strano. You guys played at the same country club together. What do you remember about playing alongside of Rob?
Well, you know, Rob was about a half a generation, I guess, behind me, maybe even more than that. But, you know, Rob was always a student of the game, and it's no surprise that he's kind of gone into the teaching aspect of it, I guess. But a beautiful swinger, and just kind of had a knack to relate, I think, as later in life, so much to his students and things like that. And I've watched and listened to Rob, you know, in front of a crowd, and how well spoken he is, and how adept he is at getting the message across. And it's really fun to see, and it's a tribute to the game and how there's different pathways for everyone. But, you know, Rob was a wonderful young player, and has parlayed that into where he is today, a very fine young man. I call him a young man. I'm 70 now, so everybody's younger than me. But I've enjoyed seeing his progress along the way and catching up to him every now and then. I think the last time we did a little thing in Belleville at St. Clair Country Club, where we grew up, we did a little honoring of my Uncle Bob, and he got up there and was very eloquent. I wish I had the skills that he has behind the microphone, but always good to see Rob and listen to him and enjoy his progress throughout his game.
You played alongside Curtis Strange, David Thorne, another great friend of the show, Bob Byman, while you were there at Wake Forest. What are some of your favorite memories from your time at Wake?
Oh, gosh. You know, we were a really good team. I tell you, we had 5 or 6, 7 guys that were solid. Obviously, Curtis was the best player. The other ones of us were kind of 2A, B, C, D, kind of that ranking. And but Curtis was a spectacular player, I say. Back in the day when 69 was a hell of a score, Curtis would turn in a 64 or 5 every now and then. I'd never seen a golfer quite like him. He was long, hit the ball high, just beautiful iron player, and loved it. He had the drive that what it took to become the great Hall of Fame player that he is. And you could see it kind of from the start. Maybe we didn't think Hall of Fame in those days, you know, in college days. But looking back, he was very consumed with the game, but at the same time, a fun-loving guy and kind of a life of the party type guy. But we had a solid team, again, from top to bottom, and we thought we were hot stuff. You know, we won a lot of tournaments. We won a couple NCAAs. You know, it's funny, through the years, we run into people or somebody will say, hey, I ran into a teammate of yours And I'll say, well, who was that? And they'll say a name. And I go, you know, I don't know who that was, because we played, but there was like a sevensome that we played, you know, a couple groups every day. And we were pretty snobbish. We didn't let anybody else into that group. But, you know, I just remember the road trips, laughing, you know, at dinner. I couldn't tell you any of my scores. And obviously I can, I know the tournaments I won and things like that, but certain shots, you know, that I lived and died for back then. Again, it's more about the camaraderie of the team golf and all that. But gosh, those, you know, you think about David Thor, he's gone on, he's played, he played to a PGA Tour golf and has settled into as a teaching pro and played up and down the Carolinas, up and down the East Coast, still going strong, had a little battle with tongue cancer and successfully got that. But Bob Byman, I don't see him as much, but every now and then I'll be somewhere and there he'll pop up, and a wonderful teacher and student of the game. And he was always the one who, you know, reading Ben Hogan's Five Fundamentals and dissecting the golf swing and everything, where most of us would just go out and play and not think about it too much. Bob was really into positions and things like that. And you know, a different personality than, say, Curtis or myself. A guy named Billy Chapman from Charlotte, he was a wonderful player. I kind of lost track of Billy. Bill Argabright was a great player, Kingsport, Tennessee, state amateur, and has had some real success throughout the years. But we, you know, we had a heck of a team, and it was fun while we were there, and carried on that tradition. And now my brother Jerry's a golf coach there. So Wake Forest is in my blood, and had son Bill go there. My daughter Fran went there. It's now Jerry's son is on the team. So it's a nice connection to have with a lot of fun people.
So you say Wake is in your blood. I know Mr. Golby went to the University of Illinois. How did it get in your blood? Was that Mr. Palmer to talk to you about it? Lanny Watkins, who was there just prior to you, did they talk to you about it? How'd you get there?
Interesting story. Bob won the Heritage in 1970. He was the only player under par that year, I think four under. And lo and behold, Lanny Watkins finished second at even par. And Lanny was maybe a junior at Wake Forest at the time. And so Bob came home, and I remember him telling me, now I'm probably a senior in high school, junior. No, I think I was a junior in high school. I was 4 years behind Lanny. And he comes home and he goes, you know, I think you ought to go to Wake Forest, because if that's the kind of players they have, you need to go there and play against the best every day, practice against the best, and, you know, see where you are. And I said, okay. And I hadn't thought about, you know, I didn't think 2 days ahead at that time, but hadn't certainly not thought about college. But also, yeah, but I did think the fact that if I went, I was going to try to go somewhere where the weather was better than Southern Illinois. And so Bob knew Jesse Haddock was the coach at Wake. And we, you know, he talked to Jesse, one thing led to another. And I went down and visited with Bob, and we met Coach Haddock. It was spring break, so no students were there. But I just kind of liked the school because it was relatively small. It's one of the smaller Division I schools and campuses in the nation. And I was, I'd been to the University of Illinois. We played our state high school there and kind of drove through the campus there. And it just seemed so vast to me. And so, you know, it was in amongst the city, I guess. And it just looked like somewhere where I would be lost. And also it was in cold weather. So Wake just seemed like a natural fit to me. And then I got a letter from Arnold that I still have in my desk today, and just about how we'd like to have you at Wake Forest and all that. Well, that was a done deal then. So I just, you know, loved it from the start. When I got down there, I thought it was a wonderful school, just right for me, until I had to start going to class. And then I realized I was out of my league a little bit, but righted the ship that way and managed 4 years, and still have wonderful friends today. From Curtis and I talk at least once a week, if not more. And, you know, guys that are on the golf team, but also people that I was in a fraternity with, I still keep in touch with. And it was just a special place and a special time. And you know, glad I was chosen to go there. And you know, it was a successful story for me.
Jay, speaking of guys you know, Tom Pertzer has become a wonderful friend over the last several years. He put us in touch with one another. Talk about competing against Tom and some of your favorite stories about those early days on the PGA Tour.
Yeah, well, Tom was, wow, what a golf swing Tom had. And he probably gets tired of hearing that because every year there would be Golf Digest and Golf Magazine were the two publications that talked about golf, and they would have a best swing on tour vote of the peers. And Tom would win almost every year. And I'd play practice rounds with him. He was just a fun guy to be around. He still is. Whenever we see each other, we're trying to get to dinner and things like that. But Tom was maybe a year or two older than me, but we kind of had a good connection. Loved to play practice rounds with Tom, loved to get paired with Tom and try to emulate his golf swing. Obviously, I couldn't. Big, strong guy, hit it a mile. And he was just a, you know, the whole package. And, you know, people will say that they're surprised he didn't win more. But the fact is, it's really hard to win a golf tournament on the PGA Tour. And, you know, Tom had a wonderful career for a long, long time. And I guess I think of him as a wonderful player, but even a better friend. And we talk all the time. We text all the time. Our birthdays are pretty similar. And so we're, you know, we pop up here and there at pro-am outings, things like that. And it's like we never missed a beat. We're just right back at it, laughing and having a great time. But he's a complete package for me. He's one of my best friends, and always enjoy being around Tom and trying to learn some from him. I feel like as a golfer, we never stop learning. At least I'm trying not to. I can't do physically what I did 40 years ago, 30 years ago, even 10 years ago. But I can try to learn more about the game and things that I can take to the course, whether it be short game or putting or something like that. But always love playing with Tom and trying to pick something up from his game.
Speaking of how hard it is to win out on, whether it's the PGA Tour or the Champions Tour, it's even harder to win majors. But you had top 10s in majors from 1977 to 2004. And to me, longevity is one of the marks of greatness. And you were in the thick of the majors for 27 years out there on the PGA Tour before winning three there on the Champions Tour. Do you embrace how great of an accomplishment that all is?
Oh, without question. It is so hard. I actually thought the U.S. Open was kind of my avenue to get a major. I thought Augusta was too long for me. I didn't play much overseas. I played in the British Open, as we called it, probably 9 or 10 times. And the PGA, I had a lot of good luck in the PGA, but I guess I felt like the Open was my forte because I hit a lot of fairways, hit a lot of greens, wasn't a birdie machine, but you didn't need to be so much in that regard. And I had a good, I think I finished fifth my first year as a pro at Southern Hills. And I thought, man, this is my game. This is where I belong. And I'm going to contend in this U.S. Open and everything. Well, it obviously never happened, but it's just, I think what comes with playing well in a major is the outside source or the outside pressure, the press, you're doing an interview, leading a tournament, and you're doing a TV interview, and another interview, and you get up the next morning, and you're in the paper, and all that stuff. If I had to do it over again, I wouldn't have listened or wouldn't have read any of that stuff, you know. But I like seeing my name in print. I like to see it up on the top of the leaderboard, and so it was a good feeling. But I do think that knowing what comes with winning a major is, you know, how great that is. I think I wanted it too much, probably like a lot of people. You know, it's just, it's a game changer, a life changer. And then early on, Curtis won, you know, in 88, 89. Here's my best buddy, and he's winning U.S. Open. And man, I've been passed by. So it's difficult, but you got to be on. You know, only four times a year, and you got to qualify for them too. You know, if you're not in the Masters or you got to qualify for the U.S. Open and all that. So if you're not in those tournaments, obviously you don't have a chance to win. But I think that, you know, when I was playing my best, I felt like I could do it, and it just never happened. And finally did at the senior PGA in 2006 at Oak Tree. I felt like I think I would have felt winning a PGA Tour major as opposed to a Champions Tour major. I was as jacked up as I've ever been, as nervous as I've ever been. So it was just my time. I got lucky. I made a nice putt here and there, and it's nice. It was nice holding that big trophy.
I want to go back to a couple of your experiences at the Masters when you mentioned that. And you battled Ben Crenshaw in the 1995 Masters deep into the back nine on Sunday. And we all know the story of Harvey Pienick passing away shortly before that tournament and how much that fueled Ben. But what was it like for you trying to battle it out with him on the back nine on Sunday?
Well, you know, I had a really good stretch in the mid-80s there. They changed from Bermuda grass greens, overseeded Bermuda grass, and they went to bent in like 83 or 84. And 84, 5, and 6, I finished maybe 4th, 5th, and 6th or something like that. And the Augusta became kind of like a U.S. Open-type course where pars were wonderful. And so I was a good two-putter. You know, I had a good lag game. And, you know, I wasn't a streaky putter. I was a good putter, never a great putter, it didn't seem like. And so I had some pretty good luck in those early days when they went to bent grass. And then I was starting to play well in the mid-90s and shot 64 the first day in 95, led the tournament. And then I was actually, the second day I shot, I think, 71-64 and had a one-shot lead. And so there's where the press, the media, everything about leading the Masters got into my head. And I was playing really well. I mean, I was as good as I've played. And so I didn't expect anything less when I went out on Saturday. But, you know, as you know, the finish is at 6:30, 7 o'clock. And so we're teeing off at 2:30 or something like that and got all morning to think about it. And I went out and I just wasn't sharp. I double bogeyed number 3. My ball moved on me right when I was getting ready to putt. So there was a penalty stroke there and ended up making double on that third hole, which is a relatively easy hole when, you know, in the big scheme of things at Augusta. End up shooting 40 on the front nine, but came back in 33. And so had a chance on Sunday and really, really felt like I was in the thick of it and right there. But Ben, you know, the stars were aligned and, you know, he had the incentive of Harvey's memory and things like that. But that was, you know, my best chance, really, that I was right there from start to finish. I had a couple decent top 10 finishes in majors, but I seemed to have good last rounds where I'd come from behind and I didn't have the pressure. Nobody was really interviewing me on Saturday afternoon. So I kind of would sneak in the back door and grab a top 5 or something like that. But that was one that I felt like got away. And you know, earlier we talked about my uncle Bob Golby, and Bob had a 1968 Masters champion, and I was up in the champions locker room many times. And just, you know, my main goal was to try to get a plaque on his locker right next to his and share that locker and have that connection with him throughout life. And never happened, but that was one of my main goals on the PGA Tour. And that was, I always said, people say you want to win the U.S. Open, the British Open, whatever. And I said, I'd always wanted to win the Masters, and mostly because of Bob.
Speaking of some of those times in the mid-80s and legendary Masters tournaments alongside Ben Crenshaw, you and Ben were paired together in the final round in 86. You ended up finished tied for 6th that year, thanks to that final round 67 that you shot, which was the second best round of the day next to Jack's.
Right.
You guys were about 8 groups ahead of him. What was it like being out on the golf course as all that was going on behind you?
Well, you know, I really learned something that week because Jack and I actually played on Saturday. I think we were both at maybe 143 or something like that, maybe. I don't know, two under. I can't remember our scores so much through two rounds. But I think Jack shot 70. I might have shot 71 the third round. And we were kind of out of it. You know, I mean, sure, a 64 and all that. I wasn't thinking 64. You know, Jack might have been. But I guess what I learned from that was you're not out of it. You know, if you've got a, if there's holes left and you're kind of close, it's, you know, you put up the numbers, there's no defense, you know, and that's what he did on Sunday. But Augusta, as many people know, when you're there, you hear certain roars around the course and you know what hole the roar came from and pretty much who created that roar. And early on Sunday, there was no other roars like when Jack was doing well. And those manual scoreboards that are on the golf course sprinkled out through the golf course. And you'd see Jack, you know, made a few birdies. And then all of a sudden that little door would kind of go open. And then here comes another birdie, you know, on the seventh hole, wherever it was. It's pretty cool to watch that. And as a player, again, you know exactly who did it, where they did it, and what it meant and how close they were and all that stuff. So that was pretty cool, but it was great to, Jackie was caddying for him. And so we were playing okay on Saturday, but just kind of treading water a little bit. But, like I said, the thing I learned was, you're never out of it. And Jack had a great knack. And I don't know if it was a learned thing or if it was just instinct for him of playing every shot the same, whether it was the first shot of the tournament, the last shot of the tournament, shooting 76 or 66 or whatever it was. He went through the same routine, gave it the same effort every single time. And I don't think there's another player in history that has done that. You know, it's just the way he approached everything. And so again, another great lesson to watch the greatest, if not the second greatest, 1A, 1B, he and Tiger. It was a fun time to play with him and see him at his best.
A little bit ago, you mentioned your first senior major victory at the 2006 PGA at Oak Tree there in Oklahoma. After all those close calls, what was it like for you? You're coming down the stretch. You end up winning in a playoff over Brad Bryan on the third playoff hole. Talk about, you mentioned nervous and all that sort of thing. What was it like for you coming down that stretch and then getting into the playoff, trying to close the deal and get that first major championship?
I was a group ahead of Brad, and the 18th hole, if you've never seen it at Oak Tree, there's a huge bunker in the front of the green, maybe a 15-foot lip to it with railroad ties, and just a very intimidating, visually intimidating hole. Winds blowing pretty good, and I'd struggled on that hole throughout the week, but hit a beautiful 5-iron second shot to about 15 or 18 feet, kind of had a big breaking left to right putt. And I was looking at the scoreboard. I was tied with Brad. Maybe he had 17 to play, and I made this putt, and the prettiest putt I've ever hit, I think. And I was, I won't say I guaranteed I was going to win, but when that putt went in and I was thinking about the, you know, getting the hardest hole on the course, if not one of the hardest in America, and how's Brad going to make a birdie to tie me and all that stuff. And damn, if he didn't do it. And, I remember we were signing our scorecards, and whoever I was playing with, and I'm trying to come up with who kind of leaned into me who as we were signing, he says, "Congratulations." Said, "No way Brad's going to bury that last hole." Well, sure enough, he did. And I guess I, at the time I thought, you know, I can't let this go. I've got to have this. And this is my, my destiny and all that, but it didn't look good. I made a nice par save to win. Brad missed a fairly short putt that would have kept the playoff going. It was just unbelievable relief, but I don't think I'll ever forget the putt I made on the 72nd hole that ultimately got me into the playoff. It was, you know, as a golfer, any athlete, I guess, when you have to do it and you do, there's just not a better feeling in the world. And so it kind of gave me chills to do it at that moment, thinking about, man, there's, this is what Jack did his whole career, and Tom Watson and Ben and all the players that have won multiple majors. So it was a pretty cool feeling to have, be able to do it when I had to. It was nothing like it.
You win that tournament again 2 years later in 2008, this time at Oak Hill Country Club up in Rochester, New York. This time you beat Bernard Langer by a stroke, and Langer's as tough as it gets on the Champions Tour. Talk about battling it out for a second major against him.
Yeah, I didn't defend very well at Canterbury in Cleveland the next year in 07, finished maybe 10th or something like that, but just didn't have it. And then went to Oak Hill, and I have a pretty good connection with Oak Hill. Billy Harmon's my best friend and my teacher, and caddied for me for 10 years on the PGA Tour, and a great friend of Tom Percher as well. And Billy worked for his brother Craig Harmon, who was the pro there for 30 some years. And so I'd been up there quite a bit, played casual rounds with Billy and Craig there, played in the PGA, played in the Open there with Curtis One. Had a lot of golf experiences there at Oak Hill. And probably the one of the indirect ways that I had some pretty good success on the Champions Tour at the Ryder Cup there in 95, we had a pretty good lead going into Sunday, and I was paired with Philip Walton from Ireland, and I was in the 11th match. Phil was in the 12th match. Phil Mickelson, and it looked like by the time we got to our matches, the matches were going to be over. Well, as things played out, Curtis maybe lost the last hole, Brad Faxon lost the last hole, different guys lost the last hole or didn't make a putt, and all of a sudden now it's down to Phil and I. Well, Phil dusted his match. He won like 4-3 or something like that. So now I'm the last match on the course. And I flat out choked. It was the most nervous I've ever been. I had won 16 and 17 to get to number 18, one down. If I win number 18, we have the match. We have the entire matches, and we retain the cup because we had it the year before, 2 years prior. And I hit a terrible drive, terrible second, terrible third. You know, I had a 6-footer for bogey. So basically, Philip, all he had to do was make bogey, and that's what he did. And probably the lowest point of my career. And so Billy Harmon was caddying for me at the time. And later on, he said, you know, I don't mean to bring up the bad time or whatever. He says, but you couldn't have hit a worse drive if you tried. If you were just in a driving contest and you took a swing like you were in a driving contest, you would hit a better drive than trying to be too perfect and all that. He wasn't being critical. And I agreed, you know, I was just trying to hit this perfect drive in the fairway and steer it out there. And so if I said, you know, from now on, if I ever get chances to win tournaments again, I'm just going to let it rip. And I'm going to take a swing like I'm in a driving contest on tight holes and last hole and things like that. And that was kind of how I got going on the Champions Tour. Well, lo and behold, in 2008, I come to the 18th hole with a one-shot lead on Bernhard at Oak Hill, the site of my biggest choke. And I said, well, I'm thinking to myself, here you go. I kind of had a chuckle just saying, here's your opportunity at the same place. And I said, come on, just don't waste time. Just get up there and swing as hard as you can swing and see what happens. And I hit the prettiest hard cut down the left side of the fairway, and I knocked it on the green, two putted, and won the tournament. So that spurred me on for the next few years too. I just felt like that's the way to play. And that's what I noticed as I look back on playing with Tom Watson or Hale Irwin or guys that won a lot of tournaments. They didn't play scared. They tried to hit a good shot as opposed to not hitting a bad shot. And I think most of my career, I was the guy trying not to hit a bad one rather than trying to hit a good one or a great one at the right time. And I learned a lot in that regard, and it helped me win more tournaments on the Champions Tour than I won on the PGA Tour. And I think it was just kind of an attitude change. I started putting a little bit better, but that was a memory that'll stick with me for a long time. Sorry to mean to get too detailed there, but
no. It's
just pretty ironic that those two shots happened at the same hole in different decades, but there's a lot of pressure on each one. One time I handled it, the next time I did.
So let's take that a step further, because speaking of hitting a great one at the right time, a year later in 2009 at the Senior Players, you get your third senior major championship. This time you're trailing Tom Watson by 5 strokes going into the final round. You come back, shoot 64, including a birdie on the final hole to win by 1. So you did it again that year. That's fantastic.
That was probably one of my best ball striking weeks of the year of my career. Baltimore Country Club has some real severe greens. Got to stay below the greens. You got to put your irons in the proper spot on the greens. And I was kind of right there all week. Wasn't putting great, but just again, tee to green, I was as good as I've ever been, I think. And I got to the 17th hole. 17 and 18 are normally number 1 and number 2, and 1's a tough par 4. And with the original first hole and then the original second hole is a par 5. And they converted that one to a par 4 and made them number 17 and 18 because they were close to the clubhouse. Well, I hit a nice shot in on 17 and made about a 15-footer for birdie. And at that time, I knew I was right there, but at the same time, Tom doesn't usually spit the bit. You know, he's going to close the deal, and I'm just trying to, you know, put as much pressure as possible on him. And the 18th hole there is a kind of a hogback, turtleback fairway, whatever you would say, is so hard to hit. And I was 0-for-3 going into the last round there. And if you don't hit the fairway, the rough was such as hard to hit the second shot onto the green up this hill. And I did hit the fairway, and I hit a beautiful iron that took the slope and went down to about 2.5 feet, and I shook this thing in. And then Tom came there and needed a birdie to tie me, and he drove in the rough, couldn't reach the green. He probably had a 40 or 50-yard blind shot up over the green. Apparently, it went right by the hole and about 5 or 6 feet by, but he made that to let me win by a shot. But that was a memory too, to beat the great Tom Watson. When I first started playing, Tom was just starting kind of his heyday, his 8 or 10 year stretch there where he was, I'm telling you, if you played late on Thursday and he played early, his name was on the leaderboard. Every time I got out to the course, it seemed like every single week that he was playing, Tom was 4, 5, 6 under on the first round, every single time he teed it up. So he was the man, and I guess I never grew out of that opinion of him. And so to nip him by a shot in a major tournament was certainly one of my great highlights of my career.
You won the Charles Schwab Cup in 2006 and 2008. How much did winning that season-long event, and not doing it once, but doing it twice, validate for you that you belong mentioned among the greatest players of all time?
Well, I won't ever say that, but it did. The validation of winning a season-long points race is just that you were consistent enough throughout the course of the year that every time you teed it up, you know, and I felt like at that stage I was playing some of my best golf and very confident, putting well, doing most everything well. And so I felt like I was going to be up there by the lead almost every time, and with a few breaks, I might could get the win and all that. Certainly would never consider myself in amongst the greats and all that. I played with many of them, but again, winning a season long points race, you know, nowadays is the FedEx Cup, and we still have the Schwab Cup on the Champions Tour. So to end up with that crown is pretty special. It just shows your consistency throughout the course of the year. And, you know, I had a few years where I won multiple events, only a couple, actually. I won in 81 and 82. I won twice each year, but the rest of the time it was pretty cold, actually. So a little streaky back then, but to begin to have that consistency and have a chance to do that was something that means a lot to me. And Lauren Roberts was kind of the main guy back then. That Lauren won twice. I think he might have won in 7 and 9 or 5 and 7 or something like that, opposite times of me. Hale had won it 3 times, I think. So some of the best players on the PGA Tour champions had put their name on that trophy. So I was pretty proud of that.
Jay, I've said this to several of your peers. I think the Charles Schwab Cup winner deserves a spot in the Masters. And winning tournaments and majors on the Champions Tour should be considered when people are thinking about players that deserve to be inducted into the World Golf Hall of Fame. Am I wrong about that?
Well, you know, I guess when I was playing as a younger player, I would say no. And I still probably lean that way. You know, there's quite a bit of difference. I do think that, you know, the media goes a little bit further when it comes to a PGA Tour Champions major. But, you know, we get into the PGA Senior Championship. We get an exemption into the PGA Tournament the following year. And the Players Championship, the same thing. The Senior Players gets into the Players Championship the following year. And I think the Senior Open Champion does the same. Senior British Open Champion gets the same. So that's pretty cool to earn our way into those majors by winning the senior majors. But as far as being recognized, you know, you look at a guy like Steve Stricker, who just dominated this year and has dominated pretty much. I think he's won 16 or 17 tournaments already, and he's kind of a part-time player out there. You know, he played very sparingly from 51 to 50 to 53 or 4, say, and then he was a captain of the President's Cup team and Ryder Cup team and all that, and that takes a great deal of time. So he didn't really play as much as most 50 and older guys do, but this year he put it all together, and heck, I don't know how many tournaments he played, but he didn't play, you know, probably 4, 5, 6 less than some of the other guys did up there. But now, do you consider, you know, Steve, there's a great example. He won, I think he won 11 times maybe on the PGA Tour. And now he's won 6 or 7 senior majors. Is he a Hall of Famer? You know, you think, let's go back to Uncle Bob. He only won 1 major, but he finished 2nd in 2 others by a stroke. You know, it's just hard to say that Champions Tour golfers, what they did strictly on that would warrant, you know, maybe as an addition to it. Yes, but I don't know. My vote would be no, but I'm cutting my own throat there. But regardless, it won't change my life. You know, it that would be great to be recognized and all that, but there are many in front of me who deserve it ahead of me. So, again, I my Hall of Fame is my 12 grandkids that we had Christmas with over here at the house. It's nothing like that. So it was a great, great ride golf wise, but no regrets, no wishes that I'd done this, that, or the other. It just, I did the best I could.
Jay, just a couple more before I let you go. And you mentioned the Ryder Cup earlier and the pressure that comes along with playing in one. You were a part of 3 Ryder Cup teams. I want to focus on the victorious one in 1983, your first appearance. Jack Nicklaus was the captain that year. It was held at PGA National in his backyard. What do you remember about the first time you teed it up at a Ryder Cup?
Some things that I'll never forget. Tom Watson and I played as partners my first match, and that was a real thrill for me because, like I said, he was the man right then. 1983 was kind of in his wheelhouse. You know, I think maybe, I don't know what his first year, first win was, maybe 76 or 7, Western Open, maybe something like that. He had a hard time closing the deal as I look back, but by the time I was playing decently on the PGA Tour, he was seemingly winning every other week. So to have him as a partner, that was very cool. And we beat, I want to say we beat Woosdom and Langer. Not 100% sure who it was, but we beat them 2-1 and we were on 17. I had about a 12 footer for birdie and I think Woosdom maybe 18 feet. We were 2 up and we wanted to close the deal and Tom came up to me. I was kind of by myself and he goes, he's going to make this one. So be ready. He's going to make it. You need to make yours to win this match. And so I thought to myself, yeah, sure, he's going to make it. Well, sure enough, he makes his putt. But that little pep talk before that putt was made really helped me because I settled in and I made the putt. We won 2-1. So that's something I'll never forget. Curtis and I paired the second day, basically begged Jack to put us together. Well, we were 2 Ryder Cup rookies that year, and we played countless rounds together. We knew each other's games. We trusted each other. We didn't lose much in college. We thought we were pretty hot stuff. And so put us out there. Well, we got out there and we won 3-2, I think, a match. So that was very cool. Played with Gil Morgan in another match and we tied Seve and whoever he was paired with. Seve knocked it on 18-2 that none of us could do except for Seve. We were 1 up going the last hole. And I was playing really well and you know, I couldn't match his birdie. I think Gil might have hit it in the water, second shot. But anyway, those are the things I remember, pouring champagne on Jack's head in the room, you know, celebrating. You know, Lanny hitting it close in the last hole there to win that hole and have his match and kind of solidify the victory. I saw a picture the other day of me hitting, and I'm not sure what hole it is. I want to say it's the 9th hole from the right side of the fairway, looking beyond the 9th fairway. There's a lake, a pond, and then the fairway, and then some trees and can't really be sure where it was, what hole it was on, but Gil is in the picture and Seve's in the picture and the official and maybe our caddies. And those are the only people in this picture. And my point is there was hardly anyone there watching it. I bet for the week, there weren't 6,000 or 8,000 people out there for the entire week to watch the Ryder Cup. Really? And there was, if you look back, and I'm pretty sure you can Google this and do your own research on it, but I'm pretty sure on Saturday, the matches on Saturday, there was an hour of tape delay telecasts on Saturday afternoon. And on Sunday, I think there was an hour and a half of tape delay telecasts for the Ryder Cup. If you can imagine that in today's world. Hell, there's an hour and a half of watching the caddies eat almost, you know, in today. But it was just that picture kind of told me the story of, and I've told people there was hardly anyone there. But I didn't know any better. We didn't know any better. And we didn't know the war on the shore was going to happen at Kiowa and Jack was going to lose at Muirfield Village and all that stuff. We were still on the roll of never being beaten and all that stuff. And it was close, but shoot, the outcome was what we expected. So we didn't think anything of it. But, you know, having Jack as a captain who, you know, in 83, he won the Masters in 86. So he was still, he should have been on a team. But there weren't picks back then. It was just a top 12. So you know, he hadn't played enough and I think he'd been on, I don't know how many teams anyway. So it wasn't like it was main goal, but in today's game and since 85 or 87, everybody wants to be on that team and do whatever they can to get on that team. But it was, those were some of the things that I'd talk about for years to come. The teams got together for dinner at Jack's house. Jack and Barbara's house, very, very casual. right there on the water. If you've ever been to Jack's house, it's right there on the bay, and tennis court right there. And I can remember watching Michael, their youngest, climb the fence of the tennis court. He's about 5 years old or something like that. Just a very, very cool experience there. Going into Jack's office, Jack only had like three pieces of memorabilia. And this might have been later than that, but he's got a picture that's maybe 4 feet wide, 3 feet tall, and it's of every greatest player of most every sport is in this picture live. They were in tuxedos, and I don't know if you've ever seen that picture. Jack and maybe Arnold and maybe Tiger and maybe Pele and maybe Bill Russell and Gretzky. I don't know. You name the best players of the last 40 or 50 years in every sport, and there's about 20 of them in this picture in tuxedos, and that's in his office. I think that's a pretty cool picture. And then maybe a British Open replica trophy is in there, and that's kind of it. Not a bunch of stuff hanging on walls and plates and, you know, plaques and things like that. Is very sparsely decorated from all of his stuff that he won. But he probably gave most of it away, and it didn't mean much to him other than just to have his name next to that victory. So, but that was kind of got off track there, but those were my 83 memories.
Jay, you mentioned about how nowadays everyone wants to get on, whether it's the U.S. team or the European team, to play in a Ryder Cup. Well, this year we heard about some guys squawking about wanting to get paid to be there. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, you know, I've been asked a lot about that. And honestly, I will tell you this. If you gave me two pieces of paper and I picked one and it said, argue for getting paid, I think I could do that very well. And if the other one was argue against getting paid, I could do that just as well and make good arguments on both sides. Now, that's kind of strange coming from a 70-year-old guy who we didn't get paid to do any of that stuff. We got a stipend, a small stipend and all that. But, you know, we weren't we didn't have the perks that they have in today's world and trying to please these guys. But I will say this. Here's a thought that someone, Billy Harmon, actually told me this. He was talking to a friend of his. And he goes, imagine if you were putting on a concert and all the top acts in the music world were coming. So let's think Live Aid. And so that was raising money for for world hunger. Is that correct?
Sounds right.
Imagine that those acts were on there for free. They were doing that for free and not getting paid for it, except the organizers got all the money. So that's kind of what happens in the Ryder Cup. The Ryder Cup funds the PGA of America. It funds the European PGA Tour a great deal. And so, you know, so here's my argument for getting more money, for getting paid, is here, these are the entertainers. These are the acts that you're putting on stage, and they're doing it because it's for their country. Now, that's a great reason, but it's almost like quietly through the years, they should have been kind of giving them a little bit more each time. You get a stipend, you get, I don't know what it is up to now. But it was a fine, you know, it wasn't going to make you rich, but it covered way more than your expenses. But imagine if they'd bumped that up a little bit more each time without saying a whole lot and just doing it, been proactive rather than, if you remember right, in, I want to say it was 99 maybe, or maybe PGA was at Medina or something, and Mark O'Meara and maybe David Duval and got into hot water for complaining that they weren't getting paid to go. And they were the ones that kind of fell on the sword there. I think they were just voicing what a lot of players had said. So you're talking 25 years ago. And they got just crucified for that. Mark did for sure, because he was maybe the one of the most outspoken ones. But so this has been going on for quite a while. Now, all that being said, to be in that room with those other 11 players, I don't think there's any greater honor in golf, certainly in team golf. To be one of those 12 guys is pretty darn special. And, you know, looking around that room, for me personally, when I would look around that room and see Ben Crenshaw sitting over here and Tom Watson and Curtis Strange and Brad Faxon, you know, Lanny was the captain in 95. It's just Phil, you know, a couple times. Boy, it was pretty cool to be on the same team as those guys and be one of those guys that went out there. The change, if I got a couple more minutes here, the huge change that I noticed in 83, like I said, there was hardly anyone there. I played 12 years later in 95 at Oak Hill. And on Tuesday at Oak Hill, we left the locker room and there were 25,000 people for a practice round on Tuesday. There was a chain link fence leading from the door, the locker room to the practice range. And the fans were hanging over this chain link fence screaming, "Go USA, USA, USA," chanting it, screaming, "Go Jay." The hair stood up on the back of my neck and I went, "Oh my God, this is a little different than I remember 12 years ago." So, that's why the guys, I think, want to play, year in and year out, to be one of those guys who's hitting those shots and trying to win that cup.
Jay, I know, I got the privilege of watching you play when you were here in Atlanta last year at the Mitsubishi Electric Classic at TPC Sugarloaf. Enjoyed seeing you on the practice range and watching you play while you were here. Looking ahead to 24, are you going to play a full schedule? Are you going to be back?
Yeah, I'm going to try to. I had back surgery September 1st, and it wasn't major, but it wasn't minor either. It was pretty tense, I guess I'd say. I came through with flying colors, and my pain that I had, the everyday chronic pain, is gone. Golf swing pain is about gone. I'd say I'm about 85% good to go, and I'm feeling better all the time. But I plan to play hopefully 10, 12, 14 events. Kind of how I play will determine a little bit of that. And I you know, hopefully I'll play well enough to warrant still being out there. And I don't want to finish in the bottom 10, bottom six, you know, every single week. If I do a little of that early on, then I'll probably say, "See you later." But I don't want to just go just to be playing. I want to play, be somewhat competitive and enjoy it to the sense that I feel like I'm getting a little bit better as the year goes on. So we'll see. I'm playing in the tournament at Hualalai, the Mitsubishi event in Hawaii, which is the 18th, 19th, 20th of next month. So I'm looking forward to that and seeing where my game is, and then go from there. We start off pretty slowly. We have only two tournaments in February, two in March. So if, you know, by the end of March, if I'm feeling pretty good, I'll be anxious to play as much as possible and pick my spots a little bit. There's certainly courses that I can't compete on anymore. They're too long for me, but there's certain ones that my game suits a little bit better than others. So. And then, you know, hopefully see Tom somewhere along the way and Curtis and some of these guys that I've grown to know through the years and enjoy the company of. So looking forward to that.
Jay, how can our listeners stay up to date with what you're doing, whether it's following you online or it's on social media?
Well, I will be honest with you. At 70, my social media is pretty lacking. But, you know, PGAtour.com is, they do a great job for us. And it's funny, you know, the PIP or whatever they call it that the PGA Tour guys have been involved in and how much they get for being, you know, socially aware. More people are, you know, they're tweeting more stuff and all that stuff. I just don't get all that. And frankly, I don't want people to know what I'm doing when I'm home. I want to be home. I want to be with my family. I've traveled, you know, for the greater part of my life and been on the road, and I'm enjoying being home when I am home. And when I am home, I enjoy being with my grandkids and kids, and not saying here I am at, you know, California Pizza Kitchen enjoying some dinner with my three grandkids, you know. So that doesn't do much for me. When I see somebody post that, I just kind of swipe it and say, tell me something I don't know. So anyway, sorry to say, you're not going to see me on Twitter and all that stuff. And I have some opinions, obviously, but, you know, who cares what I think? So that's kind of what I think about most people that share all that stuff.
Well, Jay, it has been a huge thrill for me to get to spend some time with you today. I know we've just barely scratched the surface of your great career. I hope we get the privilege of spending time with you again sometime in the future.
I'd love to do it, Chris. And thanks for being a great host. And hopefully our paths will cross soon. Give my best to Tom if you see him. And see you maybe in Atlanta again this year.
Perfect. Thank you, Jay. Happy New Year to you and your family. We'll catch up soon.
Same to you. Thank you.
Thank you, Jay. That was the great Jay Haas, folks. Is it any wonder that he comes so highly recommended as just a wonderful guy from people like Tom Percher and Rob Strano? Thanks to both of those guys for helping to set this up. And again, a guy who won 27 times between the two tours, three senior majors, won the Payne Stewart Award for his character, charity, and sportsmanship, won again the Bob Jones Award. These things all should add up to a World Golf Hall of Fame career. You don't win that many times on those two tours. You don't end up beating the same guys that you beat on the regular tour when you get out to the Champions Tour, win three majors, also win the Liberty Mutual Legends of Golf two times, without it all adding up to being a very special career, one that should get you in the Hall of Fame. I don't care that he won his three majors out on the Champions Tour. He was top 10 14 times in majors on the regular tour, graduated to the Champions Tour, kept it going, and then won out there. A fantastic guy, a fantastic career, and somebody that I'm very much looking forward to getting to know more as we get into 2024. All right, my friends, it is time for me to put a bow on this very special segment of Next on the Tee and officially now close out 2023 in season number 10 of the show. We'll be back with you here in a couple of days, Tuesday, January 2nd. We'll record episode number 1 of 2024 and season number 11. And we're going to do that with Tom Patry, Megan Francella, Dr. Bob Winters, and Jane Crafter. So I hope you'll come back and join me as we kick off a brand new season of Next on the Tee. But as always, I can't thank you enough for making us a part of your regular golf content. Until then, hit 'em straight, my friends.
Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com. RITERUG.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring. Right Rug.